You're listening to Classic Dialogues, Land Power in the Indo-Pacific, a China Land Power Study Center production. The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the guests and are not necessarily those of the Department of the Army, the U.S. Army War College, or any other agency of the U.S. government. I'm in the studio with Strategic Studies Institute researcher Major Brennan Devereaux and China Land Power Study Center Chair Josh Arostegui. Our topic of discussion is Devereaux's article, Arming Allies and Partners, How Foreign Military Sales Can Change the China Problem, which you can find at ssi.armywarcollege.edu/clsc. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thanks, Steph. Hi.
Happy to be here, Stephanie.
Brennan, tell us about the article.
Glad to. This was a simple piece. It was one of the first things I did here at SSI, and it looked at the challenge of arming our partners and our allies in the Pacific theater with the underlying assumption that they are going to be different if there were to be a conflict, right? So how are we taking a customer-driven program like foreign military sales and putting a strategic objective on it to see what we can gain on top of the intangible of our partners and allies are getting stronger? I come in with there has to be more to it than just that. And then I try to get a little creative on how we can potentially approach that problem and why we need to. And the idea that just selling equipment, while good and has its own benefits, can be better if we try to tie it to more strategic objectives.
Josh, what are your initial thoughts on the article?
First off, I really enjoyed the article, and the story of how it came about was actually a little entertaining. So not long after Brennan arrived to the Strategic Studies Institute, he found himself in the middle of a conversation between a few of us researchers talking about different initiatives that are taking place, Army initiatives in the Indo-Pacific, and measures of effectiveness, which he happens to be somewhat of an expert on coming from SAMS and everything. I then mentioned one of the key areas I was really focused on was foreign military sales in the area. And I said, I'd really love to write a paper about this. And he said, as a matter of fact, guess what? I actually have an outline on this topic. And it took me all of a second to look at that outline and go, oh my gosh, I need you to write this paper. And Brennan, I got to ask, why did you even have that outline on hand?
Stephanie, what Josh doesn't know is I had about 6 outlines on hand. I had just come off a break. I just finished up school. And I was starting the job here. I didn't know exactly what it entailed, but I figured if I came with project ideas, I would be able to write something I wanted versus write something I was told. So I had an outline on foreign military sales. I had an outline on killer robots. I had an outline on Army modernization. I was ready for what they threw at me, and there was an opportunity, and I jumped on it. But for foreign military sales specifically, I had just had the opportunity when I was at school, I was at the Basic Strategic Art Program. We did look at the Taiwan situation a little bit, and one thing that really caught my eye when we were looking at China and the challenge of how the U.S. would have a role was this war game. The CSIS had a war game about a potential conflict in the Taiwan Strait, and one of the big takeaways was the Ukraine model of, hey, we'll just start feeding them equipment during the conflict. They said, we just can't do that. That's not going to work with the geography. That's not going to work with the situation because of the theater. And so foreign military sales was that venue for how are we arming not just Taiwan, but how are we arming anyone when we're looking at the Pacific theater? Because it's going to be so challenging if a conflict does arise to start getting equipment in. So foreign military sales for me was that initial look at what are we doing now in this interwar period to arm what we say is our big center of gravity, which is our partners and our allies.
So what makes your article so different than other work I've read on the topic is your focus on categorizing the allies and partners in the region and how they complement U.S. military efforts there. Why was this a foundation of your paper? And also, you know, you really call it the European model. Why do you consider that to be a bad model when it comes to foreign military sales?
I think we have this assumption, and I say I think because I did for a very long time, that the world exists with this very clear dichotomy. You're either for us or you're against us, right? You're our ally, and if you're ally, then you're Russia's adversary, right? Or you support Russia. And we kind of paint this weird model, and I think NATO and the Cold War has really put that into our psyche. You're either part of NATO or you're part of the Warsaw Pact. You're part of the West or you're a rogue state. And the world really doesn't exist like that. And I had this big paradigm shift when I was at SAMS. We all broke up into country teams, and I'm thinking, now's my chance. I'm going to study Russia or China or Iran or North Korea. And those were all options, and I didn't get any of them. Instead, I ended up with Brazil, which ended up being really cool and an awesome experience. And we went to a steakhouse, and I loved it. But what was really fun is it challenged my paradigm on that dichotomy, because Brazil, historically, is this middle power. And I saw this when we looked at other countries, too. But this was the spark that got it for me, where, yes, they are a friend to the United States, but that doesn't mean necessarily they're an enemy to China. Historically, this is the case a lot of times outside of the major conflicts. So for me, breaking that paradigm for everybody and saying, hey, that's great. We have partners and allies in the Pacific, and we do. That's just a stamp that says, hey, here's an ally stamp. Here's a partner stamp. It's a much more complex and nuanced relationship over there. And I hope that in diving into that, I help other people shift that paradigm as well and say, hey, yes, they could be a partner in these situations under these circumstances, but maybe they're not all in on whatever the U.S. foreign policy is. And I think we need to adjust how we plan for using that center of gravity of allies and partners accordingly. If they're going to be one of our top partners, then we'll arm them, train them, work with them accordingly. It's not saying they're out of favor because they hit this middle ground. I think that's just a reality of the world. And it's definitely a reality of the Pacific, where they're geographically located next to China. And they have to play a balancing act. And I think I talk about that a little bit and how that's so different than Europe, where they do still have to do economic ties with Russia. But it's in no way, shape, or form the same thing, where they're economically potentially dependent on Russia. They could see repercussions of Russia. The United States will support Germany and France and our European allies. And it's just such a different relationship that is more unique than I think any of the theaters. And I think each theater needs to be looked at respectively because of that.
Well, in case the listeners haven't read the article yet, I'd really want you to dig into a little bit more, expand on the different categories you outline in the paper of the different partners in the region.
I thought a framework would really be helpful for looking at this. So it's great for me to just say, hey, they're all different. We should treat them differently. I think a lot of people have made such a claim, right? And so coming into the project, I looked at it through a mental model of the what, the so what, and the now what. The what is very easy. What is the problem? What's going on? And we're looking at arming our partners and allies. The so what is, hey, these are different. They're going to be adjusted based on potential conflicts, changes in relationships, diplomatic ties, things along those lines. And I think that's where a lot of the stuff out there on the conversation stops, or that's where they take a different turn than I did. And so the now what, I'm not the expert on foreign military sales. I'm not the expert on China. I know I'm sitting with one of the experts on China. The novel approach offers up a framework to really look at the problem differently. So you could take that framework and say, hey, this is completely wrong, but it's a lens to look at the problem. Or, hey, I like this lens. This lets me look at the problem a little bit differently. And what I did is I created four fun little categories. Sometimes I get a little silly with my naming conventions, but I had some fun with it to try to make it something that will stick with a reader and they can capture, other than the title, which was first, primary actors. The relationship is pretty straightforward. You could think of a South Korea or Japan, long-standing alliance. If you envision a conflict, they're one of the first countries you're talking about. How are we going to work with them is not as complex of a question as some of the others. And so that was the easiest category, and I think everyone's pretty comfortable with that. The second category I looked at was potential contributors. These are the ones that, depending on who you're talking about or the scenario that you're creating, because not every scenario in the Pacific is China has invaded Taiwan, how is the world responding? That their contributions could be different depending on that circumstance, depending on what triggered. And there's still relationships, there's still alliances, there's still treaties, but it's not a very clear cut line on all these situations. I propose that maybe these actors, these nations, can contribute in a different way, one that is still very tangible to the United States, but offers something that's not as committal as, well, I need you to get ships because we might have to go and fight the Chinese Navy. And what I talked about in this category was air defense capabilities, anti-ship capabilities, things that are generally good for that nation, but that are also clearly tangible for a conflict with China. It's also reversing that big challenge we have in the Pacific, which China has that big A2AD bubble, right? How are we penetrating it? And we look at, well, what's China going to do as it looks to push out? Maybe we can mirror that. And the potential contributors, I think, is a good nation set to potentially look at how we can mirror those bubbles around the Pacific to also threaten China's big strategic assets like their ships and their aircraft. The third category, passive supporters. So these are the countries. Oh, and just a quick caveat. I didn't go through and say, hey, this country fits in category C. Because first, I felt that would be inappropriate. That's much more of a classified conversation. And to be fair, it's not a conversation that I'm qualified to make. There are people that are, and I hope that the framework helps them do that. So the passive supporters are countries that really might not benefit from being involved in a conflict between the United States and China, but they could potentially help in other ways that are non-committal, that don't make them a target nation of the fight, that don't draw Chinese condemnation from their actions, This could be something as simple as investing in electronic warfare capabilities, intelligence capabilities, maintenance capabilities. How valuable would it be to have basing access and a nation who's dedicated and has advanced some of their resupply and sustainment type capabilities for U.S. forces? Medical capabilities, things that are vital for being able to conduct a campaign, especially if it's not the quick, decisive conflict that some people envision, but a potential protracted engagement in the Pacific to have this relationship with nations that aren't necessarily going to hard pick a side, but are willing to offer support in other ways that can still contribute to the fight without drawing themselves in. So not quite the neutral, but still a supporter, thus passive supporter versus the active supporter. And then the final nation or nation category I looked at is inward-looking nations. And I think we could probably think of a few examples. These exist all over the world. And at the end of the day, I think all nations are inward-looking nations. That's the priority. But some are only inward-looking nations. And that doesn't mean we can't have good relationships with them. It doesn't mean we don't need flyover, basing, access, things like that we could still work and develop. But it means we should potentially tailor our foreign military sales to help them in the category they care about, which is their defense, at the same time seeing how that could be leveraged to still help the United States in strategic objectives. So if we look at getting them equipment that could help deter a potential Chinese invasion or frustrate a Chinese invasion, and I hope that there's a ton of lessons learned coming out of the Ukraine-Russia conflict that says, hey, what can deter or frustrate a great power during this invasion? And those are great tools that could go to support a very inward-looking nation. Tools to destroy potential armor capabilities that are landing or driving over borders, to destroy a troop transport, again, with anti-ship capabilities, things that allow them to sustain themselves, to stay alive, ISR capabilities, and frustrate a Chinese invasion versus just really cool military equipment that looks good in a parade and gets us revenue from selling things, which is still good. Sell things, make lots of money, but I think there's value in saying, at the end of the day, what is the measure of effectiveness? The measure of performance? I sold you a lot of stuff. Effectiveness, how is this changing how America can look at the problem? How the U.S. military is approaching the problem? How does this affect our assumptions? How does this affect capabilities in the region? That idea is just a baseline framework to look at the problem differently, and I'm sure it'll be adjusted and it'll be changed. And even for someone to use it, look at it and say, this does not work, is still getting a different lens on a problem set. And that was really my novel approach and what makes this article a little different than what you'll probably find out there.
That was fantastic. You know, your articles already create a lot of buzz around the Army and the Department of Defense as a whole. I've been receiving emails asking more about it and everything. It's good stuff. And now that I know you have 5 or 6 other outlines already built up, I'm really excited to see what comes next from you.
So I got a couple things. I really want to get some friends into writing. I've recently partnered up with the Harding Project team. I'm going to write a how-to article. I recently published something on the imagined side of professional writing, the not being afraid of potential reprisals. And I'm trying to motivate some other people to get out there at the junior officer level. But there's two big projects apart from some of those small ones I'm really excited about. The first I've been working on for a very long time is a personal account of my experience during Operation Inherent Resolve and this weird ethical gray area of fighting a very technological fight against a very inferior foe and kind of what that means for the soldier on the ground. And so I've been excited about that for a long time, and I'm hoping to eventually find a home. And the second, I joke, I brought an outline with me, was killer robots. And I'm not calling it killer robots, but it's this idea of lethal autonomous weapons, the changing character of war. How is that going to impact land power specifically? And do we have uses for it? We're very quick to say, hey, no, thank you, that's not right. But the battlefield changes, policy changes, and I think we need to examine what that'll mean for war. And that's something I'm working on to hopefully publish here through the War College.
I wish we had more time. Last word to you, Josh. Give us your concluding thoughts.
Yeah, I always wish we had more time with these kinds of discussions. Thanks to both of you guys. This was fantastic. I just look forward to more of your production and reports and potential books down the road. So thanks for taking the time, Brennan.
Thank you, Josh.
Thank you for making time for this today. Listeners, for more Army War College podcasts, check out Decisive Point, Conversations on Strategy, and SSI Live.